Last week we took a quick look at Shabtai Tzvi. As I mentioned, it's definitely one of the watershed events in modern Jewish history. It made major things have never been the same. This could be said, certainly in amongst Ashkenazi Jews. I just want to say again, I'm going with the approach that, and this is what we did basically last week, that until he meets Nathan of Gaza, he was not a major player and shaker. I mean, whatever, you know, he had a certain personal charisma, attraction, etc. But there's been plenty of people like that who've come and gone and we've never heard of them. And those who were claiming, know those who claim. That's why I'm saying it this way, because, you know, if you come to me like in 5 years or 3 years, say, but Rabbi, what about this? I know, but I'm aware of that. That's what's called superimposing ex post facto. In other words, people who joined up with Shabtai Tzvi post 1665, some of them did know him beforehand, and they like superimposed things on what they claim happened earlier. And there's absolutely no proof that it really happened. So we're going with that approach in Shabtai Tzvi. And the key fact that we saw to get us back to where we're holding this week is he was in Yerushalayim, and the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim were aware he did a classic Shabtai Tzvi, which is he came, he was, you know, competent in Nigla and in Nister, in both parts of Torah. He had lived sort of a, you know, holy style life. He davened nicely and sang beautifully, that everyone agrees with. But he was a little odd and went manic and would do very strange things. And the Rabbanim and Yerushalayim were aware of that. And nonetheless, he had come through Egypt, which again, that was the standard way to come. It was, for whatever reasons, that was the easiest way to come. And he already knew Raphael Joseph, the Ghibli, I think his name was. It's called the Ghibli, I believe. Yeah, the Ghibli or Jibidi, whatever that means. Who do I have? I have Ariel Shema at night. I think he told me both of his parents speak fluent Arabic, which is very not common for the community.
No, my grandparents.
Your grandparents.
Sorry, their parents.
Yeah. People, it's like, whatever. His parents both happen to speak absolutely fluent Arabic. Very not common, right? Correct? Very not common. Right. Yeah, the most housewives have been in America for almost 100 years already. He knew we're doing Shabtai Tzvi. We're doing the more exciting part this week, actually. Shabtai Tzvi had previously met Raphael Joseph, the Ghibli, who was the head of the lay head of the Egyptian community, very well to do, interested in Kabbalah, etc., etc., well-meaning person. And you could ask some really pointed questions, and later in the class, maybe I'll answer. There's no real answer to them. There's actually an answer, but the answer is there's no answer. It's like professional, there's no answer. Now, I don't personally blame. In other words, some historians, like Gershon Shalom, partially blames the Rabbani Yerushalayim. Like, why in the world did they send this guy back to Egypt? Because that's going to start the whole ball rolling. And frankly speaking, they knew he was mentally unstable. They knew he wasn't completely stable. And they didn't think anything would come of it, because as I mentioned before, there's been plenty of unstable people throughout Jewish history. And usually nothing happened. So I don't think we should blame the Rabbanim for not realizing what's going to happen, because there was no way in the world they should have been kosher, they should have suspected that what was about to happen was about to happen. I really don't see this is going. I go with the approach that the instigator of the whole thing is Nathan of Gaza. That's my approach. So with that said and done, I don't really think there's any reason that they should have been suspicious. Anyway, so he goes back to Egypt. He goes back to Egypt to raise money for the Jewish community in Jerusalem, and he does. And when he's there, he hears about Nathan, about Natan, Nathan of Gaza. That is very fateful. This is a very fateful moment. of Jewish history. He hears that there's a guy whose name is Natan in Gaza, who is a soul healer. He's a soul healer. Do we know what a soul healer means? Soul healer. A soul doctor. What?
Like a guru?
Like a guru. Well, sort of. Okay, it means like this. Now, sort of like this. It's said in what we call reliable sources that the Arizal, if you went to meet the Arizal could take a look at you and tell you that your neshama needs this tikkun, that tikkun, the next tikkun, etc., etc. And that's how you're going to fix yourself up in Omaha. I believe they say that Reb Chaim Vital was able to do the same thing. I'm not 100% sure. That's what a soul healer is. Now, obviously, everyone dealing in that line of business may not be what we call completely honest. Okay, that Nathan of Gaza is actually of 100% Ashkenazi descent. His father's name was Elisha Ashkenazi, and he was called Elisha Ashkenazi simply for the reason that he moved from Poland, from Ashkenaz, to Eretz Israel, to Israel. A little, you know, like, let's say, I don't remember if Nathan is born in Israel or born in Poland, Germany. But he moved to the Middle East 15 to 25 years earlier. He was a known Mokobo. He was not merely a known Mokobo. I'm sure we've all heard of the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo. Has anyone heard of Rabbi Yosef Karo's fame? His most famous work is, of course, Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch, right? That's the most famous thing. His second most famous thing would be? Beit Yosef. Next, what would you say? Kesef Mishnah. Excellent. What else after that? Okay, you don't know the rest of them. Okay. He has Sefer Shalos of Tshuvos, and he also has a diary which is called Magid Meisharim. Does anyone know what Magid Meisharim is? Magid Meisharim.
This is a discussion with
Benny Joel. Excellent. Sick. Did we mention that last week briefly? No?
Okay.
Okay. Magid Meisharim. Okay. Magid Meisharim, excellent. Are the statements, advice, etc., that the Beit Yosef got from, quotes, a Magid. A Magid is a heavenly messenger. I don't want to attempt to accurately define a Magid right now. That's a very not simple issue. It's a very not simple issue. And let me explain what I mean. We know what Nevuah is relatively well. This phenomenon of what we call Magidim is not quite as well defined. The Ramchal definitely talks about it. The Ramchal himself had a Magid / claimed to have a Magid. It's mainline people accept that he had a Magid, for the records. Now, Elisha Ashkenazi, Nathan's father, printed the second half of Magid Meisharim. And that is a very critical point, which is important to understand. Because Nathan of Gaza is the ultimate insider. He's not an anonymous person. His father is a known Mokobel, who I'm pretty sure the second half of Magid Meisharim was printed 2-3 years before this, who's printed a major accepted Kabbalistic work. He's accepted as, his father's accepted as, and the father said, my son knows what he's doing, he's accepted as a real authority in Kabbalah. And that is very, very important, because the whole story only works with this fact, once we have this fact lodged in our mind and understood. Okay. He was quite, Nathan was without a question a brilliant person. No one doubts that, even his greatest, opponents. No one doubts his brilliance. I mean, he basically invented a religion, so you can't doubt his brilliance. You can't doubt his brilliance. That's at a much later stage, and we're not going to worry about the details because they're not so important. It's important that he's still around, but it's not important. The details are really not that important. Brilliant Talmud Chacham. He Ke'ilo did it what we call basically the normal way, which means he learned regular Torah until he was around 1920, got married. He was, considered one of the top students in Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz's yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz is an 100% Yosei Sfard, Spanish Talmud Chacham from that network of Sephardi Talmidei Chachamim around the Mediterranean Basin, a known person from a known rabbinic family. He was Nathan. His father-in-law was a very well-to-do merchant in Gaza. And I know today we think of there should be no Jewish community in Gaza, but actually at this point in time, the Jewish community in Gaza was much larger than the Jewish community in Yerushalayim by far. That's just how it was, In other words, whatever. I could explain that without a problem, but whatever. Anyway, so after he got married, he decides to learn Nistar. He decides to learn Kabbalah Sari. He does that pretty quickly. It doesn't take him more than a year or two to become, proficient at it. And he decides he's going to be a soul healer. Now, the million-dollar question in the whole Shabtai Tzvi episode is what is motivating Nathan? And the answer is no one knows. I mean, I know that sounds. I know, one of the guys from 2 years ago. He was around last year also. Sort of, he accused me of being the most open of any rabbi about things like this. Like, okay, that's how I am. Better for worse. Take it or leave it. No one really knows. Anyone. No one really knows. But it's a key problem. It's a very, very tremendous, tremendous historical mystery, and there's no known problem. Anyway, so Nathan is setting himself up with the soul healer in Gaza, and this is just on the way. You have to understand that the Shabtai Tzvi is in Alexandria, and it's just right up the coast. It's the natural way to go from Egypt to Israel, straight up the coast. You basically pass through Gaza. He decides he's going to stop by Nathan and find out what's going on. Why does he have so many problems? Because he was, as we say, aware of his problems up until this point. Up until this point, he was aware of his problems. Even though, again, modern psychology is 200 years, psychiatry is 200 odd years after this. But he was very aware of the fact that he had three parts of his life: manic, depressive, and normal. And he couldn't figure out what was going on with him. And so he wanted to see maybe a soul healer can help him. Yeah, okay. So he goes into Nathan of Gaza. Now, Nathan of Gaza, this is two things, I guess. He walks in, Nathan of Gaza apologizes to him. I'm very sorry, I didn't come to you earlier. You do not have any sickness. Rather, you're Mashiach. And the reason why, yeah. That's what he told him. And the reason why, that's when you're manic, that's because you're Mashiach. And when you're depressive, that's because you're suffering from Klal Yisrael's problems. From the Jewish people's problems. That's why. That's based, of course, on Yeshaya. We don't have it. This is not my regular room. See, in my regular room, I keep a Tanakh. Because there's a Tanakh here. Good. Well, Hashem. That's as it says in Yeshaya. Famous prophecies in Yeshaya, which say, that Mashiach is a person who's embarrassed, people avoid, a person who's sick, a person who's unwell, who's sick and knows illness. Okay, now, it's sort of like this. This is very key and critical. Nathan apologizes to him. So not only does he tell Shabtai Tzvi he's Mashiach, he says, I'm very sorry I didn't come to you. I had a nevuah. This is key. I had a nevuah. I had a prophecy. Hashem came to me in a prophecy and said, he got a message which I don't think the book I have right now, I don't think brings the message properly. But I had a prophecy, Kolamar Hashem, like it says in Nevi'im, the sky shop that Tzvi is going to come, he's Mashiach, and he's going to redeem Klal Yisrael. It was a proper 100% prophecy, and I'm sorry I didn't come to you. I should have really come to you, you came to me. That's what Nathan tells him. Now, Shabtai Tzvi's initial reaction is, no, I'm not Mashiach. I once thought that, but that's not true. And in a very fateful move, Nathan takes Shabtai Tzvi on a 4 to 6 week tour. I don't have the proper book at home at this one to redo the research. 4 to 6 week tour. And they travel through Eretz Israel going to different places. And Nathan is attempting to convince Shabtai Tzvi that he is Mashiach. And finally, fatefully, in Tammuz 1665, Nathan convinces Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach. Shabtai Tzvi goes manic. And they abolish Yudzayin B'Tammuz. Now, this was local. This is what we say was local. The next summer, it's going to be very, very public. Again, there was communication back in those days, took a long time. But in a local term sense, the followers of Shabtai Tzvi already started abolishing the Dalet Tzemus from, you know, the first summer. This is now we have what I call the year of Shabtai Tzvi. It runs from like June, July 1665 until September, October 1666. Okay, now, what happened next was if you're Mashiach, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to go to Yerushalayim and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Right, so they go to Yerushalayim. And now, it's quite paradoxical what happens. There's no other word for it. What happens in Yerushalayim is very paradoxical. On one hand, the Rebbeim in Yerushalayim know Shabtai Tzvi. He had just been there. They understood he was not a well person. And they don't. The reaction of the Rebbeim in Yerushalayim is approximately, you know, it'd be the reaction of everyone outside, but everyone outside, it's not going to be weighted the way it is. A significant group of them say, "Listen, we know who this guy is. He's not well. He's no way he's Mashiach. Forget it." Another group says, "I don't know. You know, Nathan Ogazin says he's Mashiach. He says he's in a prophecy." And a small minority accepted. Now, in the world at large, that's not what's going to happen, because the group who totally rejects in the world at large is going to be much smaller. And the world at large is going to be much, much smaller. But I mean, you don't blame them as much. The world at large didn't know Shabtai Tzvi at all. The Rebbeim in Yerushalayim knew him. They had dealt with him, and they knew exactly what they're dealing with. Now, the funny thing about it is even though they did not accept him, and they did not accept Nathan's prophecy as authentic, the Beis Din in Yerushalayim at large, the Beis Din of the Rishon LeZion, did not accept it as an authentic prophecy. They still, for whatever funny reasons, and this is another major mystery, they did not send out messages to, you know, Batei Dinim at large that there's this guy, Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan, and they are imposters, and stay away, and da 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 da. They did not do that. Rather, they maintain silence. And that is one of the... If they would have sent out their messages that, we know this guy, he's not normal, there's no way he's Mashiach, we met Nathan, we're not convinced this prophecy is prophecy, if that message would have gotten out, the whole story wouldn't have happened. The story would have been over before it started, because there's this network of Svardi Rabbanim who would have gotten the message around, and then it would have seeped from there into the Ashkenazi world, and the whole story would have never started. But that's not what happened. For whatever strange reasons, they did not send out, some privately, some did send out messages, but as an act of a Jewish court, they never came out with a document, we know this guy, don't touch him, da 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 da. They did not do that. And no, again, the problem with it is it's the majority of Rabbanim were not convinced, and were fakir, were convinced that he was not Mashiach. So why didn't they act on it? And later in the story, people are going to be asking, we're not going into that much detail now, that people are going to be asking them what's going on, and they're going to refuse to answer. And that's like, why? Okay. Okay. He goes up, Shabtai Tzvi goes north, and he goes to Syria. And even though in Yerushalayim he wasn't that successful, in Syria, and Halab, in Aleppo, he was very successful. And, yeah, sorry. Sorry to tell you that. And, okay, so again, you don't understand. He had, you know, he wasn't coming from nowhere, and he had support from Nathan of Gaza. You don't blame these people. The people, the Rabbanim in Aleppo, sent messages to Yerushalayim. They didn't get any clear answer. Nathan of Gaza sent them messages that he's Mashiach, I had Nevuah. They know who he is. I mean, we're going to get to, I'm not sure if we'll get there tonight, but we'll get to what the Shabtai Tzvi's main opponent did eventually, which was extremely logical, and you can ask why no one else thought of it, but whatever, Eich Shehu, the point is Nathan was the ultimate insider, and it's not so difficult. I mean, even though you can still ask questions on it, it's not like beyond the understanding of, you know, why people reacted the way they did, simply because, again, you know, believing in B'Yisrael and B'Yisrael Mashiach, one of the reasons why today we don't view it as much of a reality, I don't care who you are, as it was once viewed in the Jewish world, one of the reasons is because of this story. One of the reasons why you know, the absolute Amunah, like, and so we spoke about Night Center, and we cannot do that here, that pre-Shabtai Tzvi, people, Jews had Amunah in B'Yis HaGoyal, like this is a table. Like this is a table, people believe the Mashiach coming. And that's one thing that Shabtai Tzvi weakened. But you know what I say? I say it's a Radak in Tehillim. So it's not so Shmer. It should be expected. Just wait a second. It says in Tehillim, Peches, or Peites, let's just see, no, Peites, not Peches. Zchor Hashem Cherpas Vedach HaSesi. Yeah. Se'esi V'cheki Chorabim Amim. Hashem should remember the embarrassment of your servant and of the Jewish people that I bear all the time from the nations. I'm not giving a literal translation, just bear with it. It's easier if we don't translate poetically. Hashem Cherfu Ivecha Hashem. Your enemies Hashem were Macharif, were blasphemed. Hashem Cherfu Ikfus Mishichecha. They blaspheme the delay of the Mashiach. So the Radak says over here, what's Asher Cherfu Ikfus Mashiachacha? They blaspheme the Ikfus, the delay of Mashiach. The Bisman Mashiach, people are not going to believe Mashiach is a real thing. That's how much they're going to blaspheme it. You really think Mashiach is still coming? So this idea that we won't be able to view Mashiach as an absolute reality. Here we see the Radak talked about it, you know, 400 years before Shabtai Tzvi came. It's not so, it's like Ki'ilah and Mamash to be expected, but we can't say we're completely shocked. Okay, so he goes to Aleppo and was very successful there. He was very successful there. And it goes on to Izmir. He's originally from Izmir, whoever was here last week knows. And he, like, wreaks revenge on all of his previous opponents when he hits Izmir. He was thrown out of Izmir, you know, 12 to 15 years earlier. And the Rav of Izmir, Rabbanim Lafafa, had been there earlier. He was also one of the Yotzei Sfarad Rabbanim. You know, this is all these Yotzei Sfarad Rabbanim, like, even if they didn't go to yeshiva with each other, they had a friend who, I don't know how many yeshivas there were, but there weren't that many, and all of them, if they didn't know each other, they had friends who knew each other. So he was very well connected in the Yotzei Sfarad community, But Shabtai Tzvi was extremely, you know, mad at him because he was one of the people behind Shabtai Tzvi being thrown out. And it's a, like, unbelievably dramatic story. And I'm just going to tell you the most dramatic part of it. The whole story is like unbelievably dramatic. He comes into Izmir and goes totally manic, Shabtai Tzvi, and the key confrontation happens on a Shabbos. That the rabbi of the city, Rabbi Lefafa, is davening with his community, with his people. Shabbos morning, they're davening, and they knew that Shabtai Tzvi was mad at them and claiming all sorts of terrible things could happen to them. So after all the regular daveners came in, they locked the door. So Shabtai Tzvi sent messengers to see what's going on. They were in the middle of Psukah Dezimra. These things are very, very well documented, because Not only were there some Jews who wrote things down, there were also non-Jewish, what they're called, philo-Semites and deists, etc., who were very interested in this, living in Izmir, because it was a major city in terms of merchants, and they also wrote down what happened. So we have like extreme amount of information what happened. So they locked the door. And Shabtai Tzvi, because the shulchim, the messengers come back to Shabtai Tzvi and tell him what happened, and he comes to shul with an axe and breaks the door down. I said it was dramatic, Akiva. He breaks the door down, and they were in the middle of Psukah Dezimra, as a matter of fact. And he stops the davening and makes a whole circus over there, and he tells him it's a big tikkun, that which I broke your door down. Because I broke the klippas. You know what klippas are? Klippot? Okay, that's a Kabbalistic concept for, you know, like, you know, Kabbalistic description of the tumma, of impurities. They're described as klippot, as, you know, as peels. That's what they're described as. Okay, whatever. Anyway, so that's the famous story in Izmir, and he deposes the rabbi and puts someone else in charge and moves on. That's the very, very dramatic. He moves on to go to Constantinople. Now, in case we don't remember Turkish geography, well, Khazar. Izmir is like right here. Constantinople is here. And so he goes by boat to like this. He goes by boat over to here. He lands. And he's arrested. He's arrested on the spot when he lands. Now, Nathan and Shabtai Tzvi had been saying, he's going to go to Constantinople, take the crown off the Sultan's head, and put it on his own. And some version of this managed to get to, you know, as it could be said, if we know about it, then they knew about it too. And some version of this got to the Sultan and the Grand Vizier, Ahmed Kaprulu, who was really ruling this Ottoman Empire at the time, and they arrest him on the spot, and for around 2 months or so, he's in a prison near Constantinople. Of course, you know, the term used for the people with Shabtai Tzvi was maminim, or believers, and the term used for people who didn't believe in Shabtai Tzvi was kofrim. So heretics, ki'ila. So the believers, Shabtai Tzvi's followers, of course, made a big deal out of the fact that he wasn't killed. And that was like always, like, I don't know if this is certainly not the only time of the spin doctors in Jewish history, but these are like, the spin doctors were like moving fast over here. And they tried to make a big deal about it. Okay, after 2 months, they send him to Gallipoli. Gallipoli, I'm not a good enough map drawer to show you, but Gallipoli is right. There's Gallipoli's right over here, right around here. It's not totally, it's totally out of scale, so let's not worry about it. They send them to Gallipoli. Gallipoli in history at large is famous because the British tried to land there in the First World War and were unbelievably unsuccessful. That's what it's famous for in history at large. He was imprisoned in a prison near Gallipoli, and he was there for around 6 months. And that is, this is the major, all, this is like the high tide of Shabtaut, of Shabtai Tzvi, and what he's able to do and not do and whatever. Now, he lands in Gallipoli, Erev Pesach Mamish, and in a very famous event, he lands Erev Pesach, he finds himself a goat, and offers it as a Korban Pesach. Yeah, it's completely us. Now, he had a technical problem that there was no... when you offer a korban, what do you have to do? You have to take the certain parts of the fat from the whatever from the insides and offer them on the mizbeach. He doesn't have a mizbeach, so what does he do?
It's a campfire.
Well, very good. He lights a campfire and eats the fat himself. He says, we are the mizbeach. And he makes his famous bracha. Matir Suru. Yeah, that's a very famous episode in Gallipoli. He's in Gallipoli for around 6 months. And in the meantime, we're going to take a break from what's going on with Shabtai Tzvi and go off onto what's going on in the Jewish world at large. So what's going on? So we're going to have to distinguish between the Ashkenazi world and the Sephardi world. And in the Sephardi world, we know between a nice amount to an unbelievable amount. Because, again, all the players, are all the main players, Shabtai Tzvi, etc., etc., they're all part of what I call the Sephardi Rabbinic Nexus. This connection of all Sephardi Rabbanim, and if they don't know each other, they know people who know each other. If they're not related, their friends are related. And they're all well in connection. The Ashkenazi Rabbanim are nearly not as well in touch with what's going on, and it's not well documented. And to make life more difficult is that, as we'll see, you know, only a small minority of people were open opponents of Shabtai Tzvi. Only a small minority. I mean, we'll get to the most famous one in a moment. Yeah, we're doing really good tonight. We'll get to the most famous one in a moment. And most people were either not sure and having such great effects on the community at large, people were finally taking Yiddishkeit seriously. That was like the feeling, that was like the mainline feeling amongst Rabbanim as well. You know, I don't know if he's Mashiach or not, but Lamaya said people were finally taking Yiddishkeit seriously, and their job was to try to get Yiddishkeit people to take Yiddishkeit seriously. So most Rabbanim were parav. Small amounts of Rabbanim were pro. A small amount. It's not clear exactly how much. Is very, very unclear. And of course, the problem was, is after the fact, everyone edited things out as much as they could. So even though we have X amount, there was definitely a lot more. In other words, there was a very famous, we mentioned Rafael Joseph. There was a guy who's, I have his book in my house, but I don't remember the name of the book or his name right now, who was living, he was one of the Rabbanim. Rafael Yosef was, he's a good man from the old days. He supported, besides being in charge of the Jewish community, he supported like his own kollel, etc., etc. So he was a guy who was learning in Rafael Yosef's kollel, who wrote a diary. And the 15 pages about the year of Shabtai Tzvi, ripped out. And as, I don't remember if it's Gershon Shalom or someone else points out, well, it's a real shame we don't have those 15 pages, isn't it? Obviously, I mean, you could basically infer that he was basically pro-Shabtai Tzvi. That's what you could basically infer. But real facts, obviously, we don't have, and you can't do much more than that. But that is the key problem. That post-fact, everyone was, the people who were pro, most of them, certainly most of the Rabbanish ones, minimally in public. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. I mean, the whole story of 1650 from 1666 to 1750 is Shabtai Tzvi reverberations. That's the whole story. That's Jewish history. That's like the meat. That's like the silent music, the music behind the scenes, the spiritual crisis post Shabtai Tzvi until Chassidus. It all has to do with Shabtai Tzvi reverberations. So, okay. Okay, now, his most famous opponent's name was Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis. Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis, again, he was part of that Sephardi rabbinical network. He is the stereotypical Yotzei Sephard rabbi. He's not only 100% Yotzei Sephard, he is descended from the Ramban Nachmanides. He'd done rabbinas here, there, and the next. I don't, Gershon Sholem like is quite dichotomatic with him, which means on one hand, Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis is the king of the historical fact. He collected documents and printed them in a somewhat known sefer called Tzitzat Novel Svi. It's a Tanakhic pun, very very fitting for the Ramban's, a descendant of the Ramban, because it's Tzitzat Novel is a Tanakhic. It means like a withered flower, and it's used to describe the Malchus Yisrael. It's used to describe the kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes, that they were Tzitzas Novel Tifarta. So he's doing a Tanakhic pun on Shabtai Tzvi, that it's Tzitzas Novel Tzvi. It's a Tanakhic pun. Anyway, he collected all the documents. I definitely agree that, I mean, you could just see from his, what we call resume, that he was not a professional rabbinical politician, and that's a point we mentioned, I think, when we came back. That is one of the biggest problems in Jewish history is, there's Torah and there's money, and the two theoretically should get along, but I said theoretically. And part of being part of rabbinics in the world at large is navigating that, difficult relationship between the people who have Torah and the people who have money. And let's put it this way, that Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis is not the world's most successful in that I agree. Okay. Anyway, he had been in Rabbanus in a number of places. He had been a rabbi here, there, and the next. He ended up in Hamburg. He was the Rav of a very small shul. A very small shul means that one guy was very well-to-do. Hamburg is in Germany, is in northern Germany. It's the last point of that Sephardi network. The Sephardi network, it went north to Holland, and Hamburg is another 200, 250, maybe it's even more. 200, that's minimally 200 miles away. 200 miles northeast of that. A port, it's near Denmark. A port in northwest Germany. He was the rabbi of a small shul. Today we consider that's an abnormal rabbi. Back in those days, that was abnormal. Most shuls didn't have a full-time rabbi. The person who was, who ran that shul was very well to do, and he could afford to have his own private rabbi. And that's what Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis was doing there. Okay. So, Rabbi Yaakov, so we can get through that. He's going to definitely regret leaving. Let's just get through Yaakov Sosportis' main problems. He goes and asks what I call the logical questions and logical problems. And when I said on this 2 years ago, a guy said afterwards, like, why didn't anyone else think of these questions? He said, well, Nathan claims he's a prophet. Did any Besdin verify that? The Rambam talks about how you prove you're a prophet. Others also do. Did anyone sit down with Nathan and see if he's a prophet? He claims he had a prophecy, Shabtai Tzvi's Mashiach. I mean, if he really is a prophet, and he really had a prophecy, then okay, we You know, as the Rambam says, if you, after Beis Din goes and interrogates a prophet, if he meets the criterion, then you accept him as a prophet. I'm not sure if he's really a prophet. So the Rambam says, well, we're not sure if two Edom come and testify. We're not sure if they're telling the truth either. But Torah tells us to do it. Torah tells us to do this. So that was Rabbi Yaakov Sparta's question. Did any Beis Din interrogate him and prove that he's a prophet or not? So what he does and does the logical thing. He sends a letter to his friends in Yerushalayim. And he says, what's going on, guys? Did you interrogate the guy or not? And of course, they don't bother answering. But he infers from that that if they're not willing to answer, and Nathan never publicized that he was interrogated and verified as a prophet, then obviously he wasn't. He takes it a step farther. He also, of course, asks the other logical questions, which are, it says in Midrashim, Zohar, and in regular Midrashim, different things are going to happen when Mashiach comes. So Rabbi Yaakov Sparta's asked the logical questions. Why didn't any of these things happen? What why did they happen? And of course he asks the other question, which Zohar makes a big deal out of, and is mentioned once in Shas. He says, where's Mashiach ben Yosef? So Sabtai Tzvi's standard answer to that was, as I have a Talmud, his name was Avram Zalman. He's a Talmud of mine. And he died in Tach V'tat. He died in Poland, and the massacre is the Tach V'tat, 1648-1649. And he was really Mashiach ben Yosef. So Rabbi Yaakov Sforza says to that, that's like very strange. You know, Melchemes Gog and Magog is reaction to Mashiach proclaiming himself. And it seems that Mashiach ben Yosef is going to die from Melchemes Gog and Magog. It's nothing to do with the war in Poland. It was definitely a Jewish tragedy, but nothing to do with us. The Mashiach ben Yosef is going to die in a war between one nation and another. Lo shamanu, lo reinu, there's no proof in the interim chazal, da 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 da. Forget it. That claim that Avram Zalman is Mashiach ben Yosef is certainly not true. And he concluded, based on all of this, that there's no question at all. Shabtai Tzvi is definitely not Mashiach. Nothing to talk about. Now, as he himself says, he was a very lone voice in the world. It's not totally true. There were a couple of other people. But there were not many people who openly were willing to say this. And as Gershon Sheldon points out, you know, Rabbi Yaakov Sportus was an independent gun who did not have to care about Jewish community at large. I'm not, you know, putting down his accomplishment, but the reason why, again, the most Rabbanim, even the ones who weren't so sure about it, and there were Rabbanim who we have their diaries and they're not sure, but Lamaisa, they said, is doing so much for the Jewish community, we don't see a necessity to oppose it. Fine. That's it for the night.